Thank you all for coming. So I'm going to read from a book called the Bhagavad Gita, as it is, with the translation's purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. I'm going to read from a chapter called Knowledge of the Absolute, which is chapter 7, and this is text number 4, which is, that's not the text, by the way. Bhumir apanalova yu kamano buddha evacha ahankara iti ame binir prakriti ashtada. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego, altogether these eight constitute my separated material energies. Purport. The science of God analyzes the constitutional position of God and his diverse energies. The material nature is called prakriti, or the energy of the Lord, in his different Purusha incarnations. Expansions is described in the Sattvata Tantra. For material creation, Lord Krishna's plenary expansion assumes three Vishnus. The first one, Mahavishnu, creates the total material energy known as the Mahatattva. The second, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, enters into all the universes to create diversities in each of them. The third, Shirdakshaya Vishnu, is diffused as the all-pervading Supersoul in all the universes, is known as Paramatma. He is present even within the atoms. Anyone who knows these three Vishnus can be liberated from material entanglement. Namo Vishnu Vraya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Tanamane Namaste Sarasvatam Deve Gauravani Vicharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paskyadyade Satarane. Bhagavad Gita was spoken 5,000 years ago in a completely different civilization with a completely different mindset. And therefore, when we hear Bhagavad Gita in our present civilization with our present mindset, it seems rather primitive to some extent. For instance, Krishna in the previous verse tells Arjuna he's going to tell him everything about the material and spiritual worlds. And he does that in around 28 verses, rather than 5 million books that you can find in a library. Krishna does it in 28 verses, and here he gives a summary of the whole material energy as being made out of earth and water and fire and ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. And we can think, well, this is quite primitive. Obviously, Krishna doesn't have the same ability to discriminate and discover 108 elements in the periodical table. So we've advanced a lot. No, actually, Krishna, this earth, water, fire, and air, and ether is different from what we conceive of being earth and water and fire and air and ether. And the Vedic sciences are consistent. In other words, the Vedic science of, I guess you can say here is physics, is the same as the Vedic science of medicine or astronomy or as astrology or even the science of Dhanurveda, the science of war. They're all consistent throughout all the different sciences, and they're based upon, at least on the material platform, these five gross and three subtle elements. But when we're talking about earth, we're not talking about a cloud of earth that you can dig up in your backyard. We're talking about an energy which is called Bhumir. That energy is characterized by its stability. Actually, the elements start with air, which is characterized by movement. And air, as we can see, it moves things. Just like when we eat something, we can hear the air moving things in our body. We can hear the air moving things out of the body also. So that's air. Even the universe, it is said, is the planets are moving because of air. Similarly, from air, when things are moving, we can see that they generate friction. And from that friction comes fire. And fire has the ability to transform, So anything that has the ability to transform is under the realm of Agni. Viner, Bhumir, Apalo, Analo, which is Agni. Fire. That fire can be radiation. It can be just ordinary fire. It can be what other types of fire are there? Fire in the stomach is also fire, but it's fire combined with water. In the body, if you had pure fire, then the body would just burn up. But fire is combined in the body with water. For instance, acidity, the acid within our stomach that helps us digest food is fire combined with water. And that energy that keeps fire, that energy of fire and water combined properly, that's called Agni or Pitta. Agni is the active ingredient, and Pitta is the, what it's, Agni is the container, or actually Pitta is the container, Agni is the active ingredient. Because fire generally won't stay very stable within the body. If you have just plain fire in the body, you get acidity, sometimes ulcers. And if you get lack of fire, then you get indigestion if there's too much water. So that energy that keeps the balance between fire and water in the body is called Agni or Pitta. Depends what part you're talking about. But Agni is necessary. Without Agni, somehow in the body, we couldn't see. For instance, when we look out through these eyes, what we're doing is we're digesting light. And that digestion of light comes about, results in our being able to see. People are born with cataracts in their eyes and don't see anything. Even when the cataracts are removed, they still can't see anything. They just see light because they can't digest it and discriminate what they're seeing. So therefore, they just see different forms of light. So Agni is that fire that gives us the discrimination so we can see properly. Similarly, it gives the discrimination so we can digest the different kinds of food properly. And similarly with the other elements, fire has the power of digesting. Water has the capacity for cohesion. If you take flour and you add some water to it, then it turns into a dough and you get cohesion. Otherwise, the water will just scatter. Or the dough will just scatter. Too much water, then the flour will dissolve. Not enough water, then you'll just have just flour. You won't get a dough. And you have to have just the amount of water necessary to get the dough. So water is what sticks things together. Love is said to be a liquid quality because it sticks things together. Similarly, earth is that quality, that stability, creates stability. It has a property of smell, while water has a property of cohesion, etc., etc. They all have different properties, each one adding to the next. So when Krishna is talking about Bhumir Apalo Vayu Kamanu Buddha Evacha, ether is that element that allows space so that things fit into it. So these are energies. And they're divided into different varieties of situations in the material world. For instance, here we have a closet or a desk, whatever you want to call it, a furniture. And within this, what seems to be made out of earth, all the other elements are there also, to different degrees. We call this earth only because it has more earth than it has anything else in it. It also has fire, because if it had no fire in it, and I put my hand on it, my hand would stick to it, because it would be so cold. And if it didn't have, of course, the air, we're not going to know it. We can sit here for a long time and watch it. We won't probably see it move very much. But in the course of time, it will move. As a matter of fact, it'll disappear. And it has water because otherwise it would just fall apart. So it has all the energies. It has earth in it. It has water. It has fire. It has air. It also has ether. That's why it can be a separate entity here and taking up space. Now, it doesn't have mind, intelligence, and false ego. That's something what we have, because the soul gets the chance to get a material body, and in this body of a living entity, there's mind, intelligence, and false ego, which are also energies that we're perceptive of to some degree or another. Just like in a sane state, I think I'm this body. Of course, that's not quite sane, but it's close to it. Rather, I'm thinking I'm your body. Now, if I think I'm your body, then both of us are going to get into a lot of trouble. So that consciousness that I'm separate from everyone else, that's called ego. Now, false ego means I'm actually not the body, but at least that there is something called an ego in the body, and that ego is a product of the material nature. It's also conscious. Just like the material nature is ruling over the material energy, there's a personality called Maya, and she's ruling over the material energy, and she's also conscious, and she expands herself into every body. That's why we may have trillions of cells within the body, and they all believe that they're subservient to the false ego. Otherwise, the liver would think it was a separate entity from the stomach, and they wouldn't get along very well. If the brain thought it was different from the stomach, from everything else, didn't have an identity with the body, then you eat food, and the brain would say, oh, I couldn't care what you eat. And the liver would say, well, what are you doing, you know? And similarly, the hands would be completely different, doing something completely different. But there's a false ego in the body that keeps the whole thing working, more or less, depending upon how much in harmony we are with material nature, as a whole being. So that's called false ego. And the false ego uses the intelligence to figure out what it should do to make itself feel good, or at least not to feel bad. So that's where the mind and the intelligence come in. The soul is identifying itself with the false ego, takes itself, its interest, as being to utilize the intelligence and the mind in such a way, and the senses in such a way as to feel good. And not to feel bad. Feeling bad means you're going to die, you're going to get sick, you're going to grow old, and you get diseased. So that's bad. Most people think it's bad because it's uncomfortable. Everyone sings happy birthday, but no one sings happy death day to you. Because that's considered to be bad. And so, identifying ourselves with our false ego, we use our intelligence, and therefore our mind and senses in order to avoid the unhappy death day. Similarly, disease, sometimes we try to avoid it. Sometimes we act in such ways we don't avoid it. We seem to not enjoy it. We don't enjoy it. We don't want it, but we act in such ways to cause it. Cause birth is a more subtle topic. Subtle in the sense that we don't see our connection with what kind of birth we take, our activity, how we're determining our next birth. And old age, of course, no one wants to grow old, but it's unavoidable. Unavoidable in the sense we may, according to our activities and our karma, some people grow older quicker than others, but it's inevitable. Similarly, birth, death, old age, and disease are all inevitable. It's only a question of utilizing our intelligence and our senses and our mind in order to delay these things or to mitigate them. In any case, material science deals with these five elements particularly in different ways. They may describe it differently in terms of oxygen or the different elements of sulfur or carbon, whatever they may say. But that's basically that's what they're absorbed in, these five gross elements. And a little bit they deal with psychology in terms of the mind. But they're all imperfect. They really don't know how the material nature is working, nor do they know how the mind, intelligence, and false ego are working. Their whole knowledge is imperfect because they're missing the most important things, namely the soul, the super soul, and the supreme soul. It's like if you were trying to study, you were probably gives the example of a person's drowning in the ocean, and so the lifeguard dives into the ocean in order to save the person who's drowning, grabs a hold of his shirt and his pants, pulls him off the person, swims back to the shore, and shows everyone how he saved the person. Meanwhile, the poor person sinks into the ocean and drowns because he thinks the person was his hat and coat. So similarly, those who identify themselves with this gross and subtle body are more or less trying to take care to the best of their ability of their hat and coat. But they neglecting the person who's actually is the, well, we could say the passenger and the super soul as the driver of the body. The person who's actually conscious, the most important part of the body, they're neglecting and simply focusing on trying to maintain their hat and coat. And when the hat and coat gets into trouble, they lament. And if the hat and coat are nicely pressed and just washed, they rejoice. But they don't take care of feeding the poor person within the body. Probably gives the other example of the bird in the cage, that the bird's in the cage and he's being nicely taken care of, at least the cage is being taken care of. They're cleaning it every day, they're dusting it, they're decorating it, but they don't know that there's a bird in the cage that they're supposed to feed. And so the bird is going, beep, beep, please feed me. What's that sound of the cage? The cage is making a strange sound. Keep on cleaning it, maybe it'll go away. Beep, beep. Yes, it's going away, I can't hear it anymore. Ah! So similarly, the most important thing about this body is the soul within the body, and that's being neglected in modern science. And therefore, the most important element of this creation, the soul and the super soul, they know nothing about, and therefore their science is inadequate, at least it's imperfect. Now, they believe in chemical evolution. They believe that life came out of, sometimes they say out of nothing. Now, is that actually reasonable, that everything came out of nothing? And if everything came out of nothing, why don't more things come out of nothing? Probably to give the example, the scientists are making big, big dissertations how everything came out of nothing. So if they actually believed in it, that why don't they stay at home and maybe out of nothing they'll get their PhD degree. It'll just appear one day out of nothing. Why should they work so hard to get money? Out of nothing, gold can just come and they'll be rich. But they don't believe it. They just get money from speaking about it. Just like, for instance, we say that life comes out of life. But that's a fact. Just like if you have a lemon tree. Now, if the soul in the tree disappears, you don't get any more lemons. Sorry to tell you. It's like half the hen. People like the part of the hen that gives the egg, but they don't like the part so much that you have to feed. So one person decided, let me get rid of the part that you have to feed, cut that part off, and just take the part that gives the egg. So they cut the hen in half, and lo and behold, the egg stopped coming out. Similarly, in order for the tree to produce lemons and get the citric acid, you have to have a soul in the tree. So because of the soul's presence, its energy, and the supreme soul's presence. Therefore, citric acid is coming in practically unlimited quantities from the tree. Similarly, in this universe, there's also a soul, a supreme soul. And because of that supreme soul, we get oceans. Where do the oceans come from? Just like in our body, now it's nice and warm, it's the middle of the summer, and sometimes from our body comes water, sweat, and has salt in it. Everyone tries to get rid of it, or sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But anyhow, it's coming out, we're producing it. Similarly, where do these big oceans come from? Oceans full of salt water. They came out of the universal form of Krishna, out of his body. Where do these unlimited amounts of fire come from? It comes from, as Lord Brahma says, it's chaksha esha savita sakala grahanam rajasamasa suramurte shesha teja yas yagaya brahmati samrita kala chakra govindam adi purusham tamahang vajami. Lord Brahma, who's the engineer of the universe, he's not sentimental. He's not a fanatical religious follower of Krishna. But he's actually quite intelligent. And he declares that he's worshiping Krishna not because of sentiment, but because of his own personal experience. And that same personal experience we all have. We can observe, as he says, yats chaksha esha savita sakala grahanam, that of all the planets in the universe, this sun is very special because it's full of ashesha teja, unlimited heat and light. The scientists, they say that in one moment, the sun is giving off more heat and more light than the human society has utilized throughout its whole known existence. Inconceivable energy the sun has. But the amazing thing about the sun is its orbit. Just like in India, sometimes they take a bull and they attach the bull, its nose, if you've ever seen that, sometimes there's a ring around in the bull's nose, and they attach that ring by a rope to a pole. And the bull walks around that pole pulling a very heavy weight in order to crush grain. But the weight is so heavy that it would take 50 strong men to even move it. And yet this bull is so powerful, it can walk around perpetually pulling this heavy weight and crush grains. But although this bull is so powerful, but because it's attached by a rope through its nose, it cannot move 1 inch beyond the rope. Similarly, the sun, although it's so powerful, full of infinite effulgence, every day the sun rises at a certain time, and every day the sun sets at a certain time. Now the question is, who put the sun in such an orbit? I couldn't wear my watch today as the example, but anyhow, I have a watch. And the watch is measuring the movements of the sun. Imperfectly, because we know where the sun's going to be in 10,000 years from now. We don't know where we're going to be tomorrow. We're so intelligent, we don't know where we're going to be tomorrow. We can't remember where we were yesterday. But the sun, we know where it was yesterday, and we can know where it's going to be in 10 million years from now. So the watch is simply moving, measuring the movements of the sun. But we all know that an intelligent person made the watch. It didn't come about by accident. Similarly, whoever created the sun did it with great intelligence, so we can understand it's a supremely powerful, intelligent person. And that person, Brahma, Lord Brahma, declares as Govinda or Krishna. Now, the modern scientists, they claim life came out of chemicals. So Prabhupada gives the example, he had a disciple, Swarup Damodar, Dr. Swarup Damodar, and he was at one conference, and a man who won the Nobel Prize for chemistry, who had declared that life came out of chemicals, So in a conference, Dr. Swarup Damodar, he asked that scientist, "My dear scientist, you've won the Nobel Prize for declaring that life has come out of chemicals. So if I give you those chemicals, can you produce life?" And the scientist said, "Well, I don't know." So why do they give you the... Of course, he didn't tell him. Why do they give the Nobel Prize? For what? He's declaring that life came out of chemicals, but he can't produce life from chemicals. So what kind of science is that? Just like they say everything came out of nothing. But in order to describe it, they have a huge book with all kinds of mathematical equations to describe the nothing that it came out of. But they really don't know. But we know. We know we didn't come out of nothing. Just like everyone here has a father and mother. Does anyone want to dispute that? I remember when I was young, we asked my parents, "Where did I come from?" And they said, "You came from the stalk." I guess the stalk had a wife or something, but anyhow, the stalk brought us. But later on, I found out it was actually my parents. So all of us have a mother and father, and we know that our fathers and mothers had a father and mother. And our fathers and mothers' grandparents, they also had fathers and mothers. So where in that equation, or in that book, the ancestry book, what do they call that? Your family tree. So where in that family tree, if you turn the pages, you turn the pages, and suddenly you turn a page and there's a monkey hanging from a tree, full of hair. That's Uncle Harry. And then you turn the page, and you turn the page, and then you find a little black sheep. And you ask your parents, "Who's that?" And they say, "Well, that's the black sheep of the family that no one's supposed to know about. We don't talk about her." And you keep on turning the pages and finally see a rock. Before that, you find a little mouse. That's Grandfather Squeaky. And finally you turn the page and there's a rock. And a little, you know, this is Grandfather Rock, the most solid member of our family. Steady, who's the most steady, therefore we call him Steady as a Rock. And then the next last page is nothing on it, because that's Grandfather Nothing. He was good for nothing. And his mother keeps on telling him, "You're good for nothing." And he said, "Yeah, I got to admit, I'm nothing. I can't make anything out of myself." "Well, try real hard." So after a long, long time, Grandfather Nothing tried real hard. And some gas came out. And his mother said, "Just some gas, get it together." So he got it together and made a little rock. So that's all you can make out of yourself is a little pebble? That's embarrassing. So he got frustrated, embarrassed, and exploded. Flew everywhere for a long time, billions of years, and finally Mother Nothing said, "Why don't you just settle down?" So here we are now. So this is called science. But we call it science fiction. Because science is supposed to be something that you can actually observe. That is, science means you have a theory, you have an experiment, you have observations, and then you can come to a conclusion. But without any, they have a theory, life came out of chemicals, or life came out of nothing, whatever. But they have no experiment to prove it, nor do they have observations that actually confirm it. They just reach a conclusion. They have their theory and conclusion, but there's no experiment or observation. If everything came out of nothing, why don't more things come out of nothing? But that they can't answer. But in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that the body that we have, the Sanskrit is, Dainosmi nita dehe komaram yovanam jara tita dahantara praptir diryas tatra namuyati. Krishna says that the body is always changing, and that we all have experience of. No one's body is exactly the way it was when they were a baby. Some people may claim that they have exactly the same body, but then we'd have to see what their mother looks like if they had that body in the womb. It would be quite interesting. Objectively speaking, everyone would have to admit that their body has changed. But we ourselves, the observer or the experiencer of what the body has gone through, we're the same person. Otherwise, how could we remember being in a 5-year-old body or a 15-year-old body or in our body that we had yesterday? That if we were a different person, if we changed along with the body, then there would be a different person experiencing each one of the changing bodies. Therefore, the conclusion is the conscious person who's observing all the different changes of the body is the same, but the body and the mind and the intelligence that he's observing is different. Therefore, we're eternal, but that which we're experiencing presently is all temporary. At least the forms that it's taking is temporary. Therefore, that's science. Science means that it's true for now, and it'll be true for 10 billion years from now, as it was true 5,000 years ago when Krishna spoke it. It wasn't that Krishna 5,000 years ago, he was speaking to Arjuna a Hindu philosophy. It wasn't that there was some, right before the battle, Krishna turns to Arjuna and says, "My dear Arjuna, you look a little nervous. So I think I'm going to speak to you some philosophy, Hindu philosophy, because I'm a Hindu god." And luckily you happen to be a Hindu also. So according to Hindu philosophy, all Hindus have bodies that change, unlike everyone else. Luckily for Hindus, they have a soul, which no one else has. And therefore when Hindus, when their body disappears, there's at least a Hindu soul left. No, Krishna wasn't speaking as a Hindu god, nor was he speaking to Arjuna as a Hindu, nor was he speaking Hindu philosophy. He was speaking science, because everyone, every living entity, not only in the human form of life, but in all the different species of life, have bodies that change. But the person or persons, or the souls within the bodies that are conscious in all the different species of life, they're not changing. But there is a time when the soul leaves the body. So as the soul didn't change when he had the change of body, either in birth or in youth or in old age, so when the body so-called dies, then the soul simply goes on to another body. And it's a question of consciousness, of being sober-minded and accepting that. Just like it's a question of being sober and appreciating that there's a supreme intelligence in the universe, and not looking at the sun as simply a ball of fire that came about by accident, or when we drink water, thinking that this was just an accident. No, it's actually a gift from the Supreme Person. And to appreciate that this is the energy coming from the Supreme Person in order to quench my thirst, that's called personalism. Just to accept that there's a power that's produced this water, that's called impersonalism. And to think it came out of nothing, that's called Mayavadi avoidism. So there are different conceptions of the universe, and according to our conception, we're going to become more comfortable or more uncomfortable with the universe. If we think that the universe is simply here out of accident, that there's no purpose behind it, there's no one controlling it, it's a very fearful state of consciousness, purposelessness, that whatever you do is a waste of time and that there's no purpose and at the end you just disappear. Not a very exciting and enlivening prospect. But to understand how the universe has a purpose, and the purpose of the universe is clear. It's to get us out of the material concept of life so we can realize at least that we're eternal. Because if we realize we're eternal, then all our material problems are solved. The problems of this body will never be solved because the body has to die. Sorry for the bad news. As Maharaj Yudhisthira was speaking to his father, Yaksharaj, in the form of a yaksha. Yamaraj in the form of a yaksha, he was speaking to him. And Maharaj Yudhisthira was asked the question by his father, what is the most amazing thing? So Yudhisthira Maharaj replied, Ahani, ahani, bhutani, gacchanti, yamalayam, shesha, stavri, icchanti, kimascharyam, atakpuram. The most amazing thing is that day after day, we're seeing that so many living entities are dying. But those who remain behind, they think they're going to be here forever. So that is quite amazing if you think about it. How many of us really believe that in any instant we might disappear from here? Do we really accept that? No, most of us say yes. Just like one time one student said, Swamiji, you said in your lecture to Prabhupada that if I act like a dog, then I'll become a dog. So I want you to know, Swamiji, that I don't mind if I become a dog. I want to become a dog. Now, if you had a magic wand and you say, so be it. As Prabhupada said, so you have my blessings. But actually, if you had a magic wand, he said, right now I'm going to make you into a dog. Do you think anyone's really, oh yeah, wow. No, people become afraid. They don't want to really become a dog. They just say like that. But there are many dogs. And how did they become a dog? Because the soul is getting a body according to its work and according to its desire. And therefore there are laws of material nature that we're working under. And if we want to become peaceful, then we have to get out of this bodily concept of life. Because whatever body we get, there's going to be suffering. Because we're going to be afraid of dying. And we don't know where we're going after we leave this body. And at any moment we have to leave this body, we're going to go somewhere. If we accept the fact that we're eternal, then we eternally have to exist somewhere. And right now if we look around, most of us wouldn't want to be existing as a tree or even as a bird or as an ant. And I can tell you every summer I discover there's a lot of ants because they all visit me in my room. They all come for prasadam. So a lot of people never believe that either they're eternal or that they might get a different body, even the body of an ant. But we can also remain in our original spiritual identity, and that's a whole different subject matter. But the idea is that all this energy that we see around us, it's non-different from the Supreme, because it came from the Supreme. It's being controlled by the Supreme. Although it says in this verse, it's his separated energy. Therefore, he's not responsible for what's going on here. Separated energy means that just like I'm speaking right now and this is being recorded and it will be perhaps played back in the future. So the recording is not different from what I'm saying right now. It's the same energy, but I won't be there. So it's my energy, but it's separated from me. Just like when we look into a mirror, we see a reflection. So that reflection comes from me, or from you or from us, but it's different from us. It's exactly the same, but it's a reflection. Therefore, I'm there, but I'm not there. Similarly, Krishna expands himself into all this different energy, so he's present here in the form of his energy, but he's personally not present here. Therefore, it's called his separated energy. But that same separated energy has a purpose, and that purpose is it can be utilized according to Krishna's instructions. If we utilize it according to Krishna's instructions, then we get free from the material concept of life, and we become liberated. We exist in our eternal spiritual identity in relationship to Krishna, because it's all a relationship with Krishna. Krishna is not separated, actually, in one sense, either from his energy or from us. That's what the science of devotional service is about. We always have a connection with Krishna. Now, we can study Krishna's books, such as Srimad Bhagavatam. We can go into the 10th canto and hear about how Krishna acts with his liberated associates in the spiritual world. But that's far, far away from us. What is right now, we're in Krishna's external energy. We have a relation with Krishna right now. He's all around us. He's everything around us. So, and we have a relationship with him through his different energies presently. So to find out what that relationship is with Krishna through these energies that we're presently involved in, mainly this material world, that's much more important for us than hearing about Krishna's activities with his liberated souls in the spiritual world. So that's what Bhagavad Gita is primarily about, is that we can appreciate how the energies that we're dealing with right now, they're not simply impersonal energies coming out of nothing, having no purpose, and that we're purposeless, and that we came out of nothing by chance or by accident, and that when we leave this body, we just merge into some void. That's called ignorance. First of all, it's not something which is really enlivening. I remember when I was a college student, there was Timothy Leary, and he was giving a talk in New York. So there wasn't much philosophy or knowledge that made any sense anyhow, so we decided to go and hear his philosophy. And when we found out that actually his philosophy is we just disappear after we leave this body, it wasn't very encouraging. He was very encouraged. He said everything is painful, and therefore when you leave, all the pain goes away because you go away. But it doesn't, it's just like if you ask a reasonable person that you have a pain in your toe, so if you take a gun to your head and you shoot your head, you commit suicide by shooting yourself in the head, the pain will go away. So it's an easy solution. Only costs a bullet. Otherwise, you may have to go and get an operation. It may be very expensive. But a reasonable person wouldn't be very much excited. Yeah, wow, good solution. Fast solution, too. I never thought of such a quick, easy solution, getting rid of the pain. But the real solution is to wake up, and that's why Krishna speaks Bhagavad Gita. That's why Srimad Bhagavatam is there, to give us practical examples of how we can live personally in this life, utilizing the very energies that we have around us in such a way as to elevate ourselves, to understand our eternality, to understand and perceive and develop a relationship with the person who's controlling everything. And if we do that, then in that sense, in Krishna's sense, then our life becomes successful. Otherwise, if you make billions of dollars, it's like you decorate the cage, you put gold trimmings on it, and fill it with diamonds, but you neglect the bird in the cage. The bird in the cage doesn't get anything. No food, no water, no appreciation, nothing. Just a big decoration for the cage. Then what is the value for the bird? So simply to work with the material nature and not know its purpose, not know what it's meant for, not feed the bird in the cage, is useless. But even a little effort at helping the bird in the cage will actually be very valuable, at least for the bird. So a little something for ourselves as spiritual souls, a little spiritual food, a little Hare Krishna, a little prasadam goes a long way. So thank you. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Gaur Premanande. Any questions? Yes.
What is the correct attitude to our Mother Earth, spiritual and material planets like hellish and heavenly planets? The right attitude, correction.
Well, the great right attitude is actually it's Krishna's Earth, and it's meant to please Krishna, to serve Krishna. So we live on this planet Earth, and we utilize its resources in the service of Krishna to the best of our abilities.
Does Mother Earth have a soul like?
Yeah, she's personified as Bhumi, as it says here. Bhumi in the Krishna's pastimes appeared as Bhumi personified in the form of a cow and complained to Brahma with tears in her eyes that she was being misused. And that was in an age where people were much more in harmony with nature than we are now. So Bhumi is even, she doesn't even try to go anywhere and complain.
Thank you.
But, as Prabhupada once said, her complaint will be that we're going to starve to death if we don't take care of her. Earthquakes, floods, this is her complaints nowadays. Yes.
Maharaj, thank you. You nicely explained this connection with all these material elements and connected with Krishna. Can you explain, you mentioned that we are the soul, soul gets a body and all this. How does this, we usually, how to say, accept that we are body, but we should train our consciousness to be as we are, like the soul. So how this, how does then a person act, how is this consciousness being noticed, and how does it manifest, and what does it happen?
Well, if one wants to understand oneself in full, there are three stages. One of them is to understand that everything here belongs to the Supreme Person, Krishna. That's the first stage. And if we accept everything belongs to Krishna, then we get free from the bodily concept of life, because that includes that this body belongs to Krishna too, and that I belong to Krishna. So that's the first stage, accepting that everything here belongs to Krishna. And the next stage is to utilize everything in Krishna's service. In order to do that, we have to take direction from Krishna. And he has his representatives externally as Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, and internally as a supersoul. So when we take direction from him, then we become free from this idea that we're acting independently. That's called Paramatma realization. And then when we realize that actually Krishna has a purpose, that is to develop a loving relationship with him, and therefore we try to do whatever we're doing, not only in the recognition that everything here belongs to Krishna, and then taking guidance from Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, but also doing it with care and attention to please him, doing it nicely, then that's called bhakti. And we realize Krishna is Bhagavan, the most attractive, loving person. So that comes in three stages. There is sometimes called karma yoga, jnana yoga, and bhakti yoga. Karma yoga is to accept and utilize everything dutifully. Next thing is to find out what Krishna actually wants us to do with his energy, what the purpose of these energies are. It's not only duty, but he has a purpose, personally himself, what he wants us to do with it. And the last thing is he wants us to have a loving relationship with him. That's called bhakti yoga. Yes.
Thank you for the lecture. I wanted to ask, nowadays humans like manufacture babies in labs, and animals can be cloned with just a few cells. So when Krishna sees that the cells are being cloned, does he like put a soul in? Like, how does it work?
Yeah, that's how it works. Just like probably, as I gave the example before, as Prabhupada used to give, that the communists, they brought together some villages and they asked them, you know, who is better, your God is better or we're better? So they said, well, I think our God is better. So they said, all right, well, you go to church, you pray to your God for bread. So they all went to the peasants went to the church and prayed to God, oh God, please give us our daily bread. And then they came back and the communists asked, so, dear peasants, comrade peasants, so did you get any bread? They said, no, dear comrade masters, we didn't get any bread. So the communists said, well, please pray to us for the bread. So they said, oh, dear communist friends, please give us our daily bread. So then the communists brought all this bread and they distributed it. And then they asked the peasants, oh, peasants, who's better, your God is better or we're better? And they said, oh, dear communist friends, you're better because you give us our daily bread. The Prabhupada said, if I was there, I would have stood up and said, dear communist friends, where did you get the bread from? So this so-called cloning means that they take an ovum and a sperm cell and they bring it together, just artificially. But they didn't manufacture the ovum, they didn't manufacture the sperm, they're just taking from people. They're taking from life. They're not producing life. They just take life. They're taking from one life and another life, and they're putting it together. This just artificially. That's all. And then taking the credit for it. But we can just imagine the karma of the person who was artificially made like that. Not very good karma. Probably it was formerly two scientists. But it's not, they're not creating life. They're simply artificially bringing things together, that's all.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. I would like to ask if we get like diseased or something like this, like mentally or bodily, some disease, does that mean that we are not living in harmony with Krishna's energy?
It means we didn't live in harmony with Krishna's energy. Yeah. But then again, in the present society, everything is okay. I mean, that's our past karma, but that doesn't mean that we have to spend our whole life trying to figure out what went wrong, because it's so many lifetimes. But we should live in harmony with Krishna, which is the most important thing, and then automatically we're in harmony with his energies, no matter what our material circumstances are, by following the process of sadhana bhakti, especially chanting Hare Krishna. Because after all, even in Krishna's pastimes, great devotees, such as Vasudev Dat, who was a leper, his body was full of leprosy. But he was very magnanimous, so although the worms in his body were eating his body, making holes in his body, every time a worm would fall out from one of those holes, Vasudev Dat would pick it up and put Vasudev the leper would pick it up and put it back in the hole so it can continue its lunch. So he was a great devotee, so great that when he heard that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in a certain village, he immediately ran to the village, but he got there too late. And therefore Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had left. So Vasudev the leper, he fell unconscious out of great feelings of great separation from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, being omniscient, immediately came back, and when he saw the leper unconscious, he embraced him, and then the leprosy and his feelings of separation of the Vasudeva the leper, feeling separation from Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, went away, and instead he got a beautiful golden body, healthy body. So there's no impediment having a diseased body. What we should do is make the best use of a bad bargain, because after all, whether you have a Rolls Royce or you have a Ford or whatever you have, or a Volkswagen or a bicycle, simply you have to utilize it to get to your destination. I had a question of what the quality of the car is. The question is utilizing it for the destination. So if we accept our destination as become Krishna conscious, then whatever vehicle we're in, we can utilize that to bring us to that destination. We follow the proper process with a proper understanding.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Grantharaj Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Premanande.